believe we probably have some minutes. Representative New, would you like to move the minutes?
I would like to move the minutes.
Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 From February 20th. Okay, first up today we have House File 2327, with Representative Bonner. Go ahead. Committee, although you're here all the time.
Yes. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2327, and I do have an amendment to move as well.
Thank you, Representative, and I believe we're going to re-refer this to Gov Operations.
Correct. My apologies.
Okay. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the amendment, and I'm not sure how it's coded.
Coded A20.
Okay, we'll move the A20 amendment.
Would you like to speak to the amendment?
Essentially, this gets the bill into the shape in which I would like it.
Okay. Any questions to the A20 amendment? Seeing no questions, all in favor of the A20 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The ayes have it. No. Any opposed, please say nay. The ayes do have it. To your bill as amended.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today we are here to talk about House File 2327 regarding polling place prohibitions. Minnesota state law actually established these provisions back in 1893, and they stood proudly for 125 years. About 10 other states have similar laws on the books. Largely, those have been upheld by the 1992 decision of Burston versus Freeman, and it was later upheld by the Eighth Circuit Court upholding statute 211B.11, stating that the Minnesota law was both viewpoint neutral and facially reasonable. The intent of this bill is, of course, to provide a zone that is free of influence, in which citizens can feel free to exercise their civic duty, free of intimidation, and to maintain a sanctuary to vote your conscience without interference or noise. Indeed, the Supreme Court Justice Roberts stated that casting a vote is a weighty civic act, akin to a jury's return of a verdict or a representative's vote on a piece of legislation. He went on further to say that it is not a time for choosing, it is a time for campaigning. But as you know, in 2018, we did have a case before the Supreme Court in which the Supreme Court justices suggested that the law was too vague and that it lacked objective and workable standards. And the Supreme Court also went on to indicate that if a state wants to set its polling place apart as an area free of partisan discord, it must employ a more discernible approach than the one we had previously offered. And they pointed specifically to cases out in California and Texas, which they claimed had more lucid terms or more clarity around specifically what those provisions would be. A number of the justices were, in fact, of course, sympathetic to the idea that some political speech could intimidate voters or undermine the solemnness, sanctity, and decorum of the polling place. But the majority made a couple things abundantly clear. It said that the state can reasonably decide to ban some forms of advocacy in polling places, and Minnesota can choose to prohibit certain apparel because of the messages it conveys. I've carefully studied the Supreme Court ruling and the laws of 13 other states, including those cited by the justices, as the best examples of clear and workable standards. Based on the amendment that's been offered here today, which is now House File 2327, it offers crisp and concise language in simple terms in line with the majority opinion offered by the Supreme Court justices. And I will leave you with this once again. The whole point point of the reason we are here today is to follow along with the example cited by Justice Roberts, that casting the vote is a weighty civic act. It is akin to a jury's return of a verdict or a representative's vote on a piece of legislation. It is, in fact, a time for choosing and not campaigning. And with that, members, I do have some testifiers here today to speak to the bill.
Great. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And we'll hold questions until after your testifiers. So please bring down your testifier. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, thanks. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State, here to support House File 2327. I'll be quick. I think Representative Bonner did a good job of summing it up, which is that the U.S. Supreme Court, in a Minnesota-based case, said a couple years ago now that simply barring political items from the polling place is unconstitutional under the First Amendment. That is just too vague. And there was one great passage in the opinion that said something about saying political requires the election judges or the poll workers to have a mental list or inventory of everything that's political. You can't possibly do that. And they made a good point. So, for example, could you wear a hashtag MeToo shirt? Is that too political? Or could you say, I support the Second Amendment? Is that too political? And they said it was impossible to administer and therefore void under the First Amendment. So we have kind of a dead statute on the books. The words still say that you can't have anything political, but this would conform our statute to what the Supreme Court said. I think this bill has some sensible boundaries. It says you can't have candidate stuff and logos and likenesses, and that seems to be what the court was telegraphing. And frankly, in conferring with our legal counsel, external and internal legal counsel, this bill is very close to the mark of what we're telling counties. We've had 2 years where the counties are saying, okay, Supreme Court said that portions of the statute are unconstitutional, what can we ban? And this bill is a very close mirror to what we've told counties our interpretation of the world is or the statute is after the Supreme Court case. So that's all I really want to say. It's consistent with our legal interpretation. Thank you, members.
Mr. Secretary, I don't know if you might want to sit there because we possibly have some questions coming. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Secretary, I think it was last year that you came and made a presentation roughly about this finding. And in that presentation, you said that that if someone wore a political T-shirt in a polling place, but it was for an election that was not then being conducted. So let's say it was one of our friends across the street. It said, you know, vote for Senator, pick a name. But it was not during one of their elections. You said at that time that that was an acceptable practice, that they could do that because it wasn't an active election. Well, the bill that we have in front of us seems to fly in the face of that commentary that you gave us last year. So I'm a little confused and would ask, you say it's your legal expert's opinion, but is that going to stand up to the scrutiny of the Supreme Court case? Because I'm going on what you told me last time, and I'm just now confused about what's being proposed in front of us.
Yes.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, that's a fair point. I didn't mean to induce confusion, and I did say that. And I still think, to be honest, the safest course would be to say that what counties and cities can ban is a candidate or likenesses or images or logos and so forth of a candidate who appears on the ballot in that election year or in that contest. I think that's true. But there is some room there. I mean, even we can see that and the lawyers can see that. There is some room there. What the Supreme Court will do, I don't know. It depends on your risk tolerance. It is true that a stricter reading would say only someone who appears that day. So for example, someone wanted to wear their Norm Coleman T-shirt or their Al Franken T-shirt or their Mark Dayton T-shirt or their Tim Pawlenty T-shirt, that, you know, that would be okay because it's it doesn't appear that day.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you. And well, And Mr. Secretary, but the amendment, now that it has been engrossed into the bill, doesn't allow for that. And I have some pretty significant concerns, because let's say somebody wore an old T-shirt of mine, Jim Nash for mayor, to the polling place.
Right.
Well, I'm not running for mayor anymore, but according to this, they're going to get asked to step outside and ditch the T-shirt, which would make me sad. But again, I'm going on what you told me last year. And now it seems that you're coming back and saying, well, while that may be true, I'm advocating for more or different. And I find that a little disconcerting. And part of the question that I have for you is that truly what you're saying? But also, in the eventuality that this were to get passed, and I'm not sure, I'll ask the author about her co-author over in the Senate, but if this were to happen, I think we're looking at another lawsuit. And what was the cost of the lawsuit last time? There's several questions in there, Mr.
Mr. Secretary, I'm just going to throw in another question to add clarity. If it was a previous person that ran for mayor and had their name on their shirt, that, as far as I understand, this would not cause any concern. But even though Representative Nash used to be mayor, if his name was actually on the ballot, that would seem to create that area of confusion and a likeness referencing him. So I will turn it over to you now to respond.
Mr. Chair, I agree with that. And I just want to make clear, different people can have different interpretations. We have, to be candid, offered what I would say is the safest advice to the counties. You can look at it. It's in writing, where we say better to say that you can only ban a candidate or likeness or logo or whatever the language is of a candidate who's on the ballot that day. That is our advice. I want to be clear. But there is a reasonable interpretation consistent with our read of the case that this bill would be permissible. But you're right. You're always rolling the dice, and it depends on every legislator's risk tolerance. That's true. There might be a lawsuit. That's absolutely true. You bring up a fascinating hypothetical. It's a perfect law exam question, actually, about what happens if it's for a different office. What if it's Jim Nash and it's a mayoral T-shirt? You're on the ballot that day for a different office. Does that count? I think I know how I'd answer that exam question, but it's a fair question to ask. So I want to be straight with you. My analysis is the same from last year. We are advising this. We are taking the more conservative, cautious approach, saying limiting it to someone who's on the ballot that day.
And Mr. Chair, I did have a second part of that question that I didn't get an answer to.
Go ahead. Before you go to your second part, I'm just going to ask the bill author if she'd be open to an amendment that might add on the ballot into the language
just
in a future amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, the language that is currently in the bill is actually consistent with both of the examples that the Supreme Court justices held up as a shining example of what to do. Both in California and in Texas, and it is consistent across the board. So that leads me to believe that the justices do actually believe in this language. This language is even slightly more crisp in some respects than the California bill. But it is consistent with both of those states in which the justices held up as an example of what we should be doing.
Thank you. Representative Bonner, and I'll come back to you, Representative Nash, because you don't believe that your whole question was answered, though there were three or four, I think, in your question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it was a multi-part question if we're talking about test questions.
Mm-hmm.
What was the cost of the lawsuit
from
the last year? Because I believe that this bill is going to incite another case, and if what you told me last year was we feel comfortable with the way things are currently, why do we have this? Because this is going to now incite another lawsuit when, according to you last year, you could abide by the findings of the Supreme Court.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair, two part response. First, the answer to your question is about $1.2 million. That's what it costs, $1.2 million. To your second question, Yeah, it's always a roll of the dice. I think the important thing is to clean up the statute one way or another. So whether you or others have an amendment in mind to do that, right now we have kind of a dead statute. I mean, it's on the books. It says what it says on the page, but the Supreme Court has made it inoperable, basically, at least in part. And so I think changing the statute in some way to conform to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, I think, is an important thing to do. I think it's confusing to the public. They look at a statute in the statute books, and they would have to know that the Supreme Court has limited its force in some way. And so I just think it's a good practice. But some limitation is in order. It depends on how far you want to go. I defer to the author on that, but I've shared with you our interpretation, or at least our advice to the counties, which is no question on the cautious side.
I would just thank you, Mr. Secretary. I would just reiterate that maybe Representative Nash, you and Bonner can get together, and maybe if we do tweak a little bit to add a candidate whose name appears on the ballot or something like that nature, because we are going to government operations after this, and there'll be opportunities to make those slight variations and add even a little bit more clarity. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, in reviewing the A20 amendment, I'm not an attorney. I don't play one on TV, but I do work with a lot of attorneys, obviously, coming across in the legislature. Some are members. And one thing I've learned is that over the years, we don't want to adopt state law that could be interpreted as arbitrary and capricious. Mm-hmm. And so if this bill were to become law as the A20 amendment has presented it, I'd like to pursue kind of some background questions on who is going to be the arbiter at the polling place to determine whether the things that are enumerated here in lines 1.17 through 1.19, who's going to determine what a likeness of a candidate is?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, it would be the polling place workers. It would be the election judges.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. So I will use a Republican mascot as an example. If I walked in with a T-shirt that had a picture of a Disney character that was an elephant, would that be deemed as a likeness or an image?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, that is a tough call. It really is. That's the best answer I can give you. Let me give you another one. This was a real live example that was been told, as only a half joke. One of my colleagues, the now former Colorado Secretary of State, tells the story about there was a kerfuffle in a polling place because someone came in on an election day in which former President Obama was on the ballot, and they were wearing a shirt that said Bama, as in Alabama. And they had to get in an argument about whether it was code for Obama. No, it was someone either from Alabama or who liked the Crimson Tide, you know, sports programs. So these are tough judgment calls. There's no question about it. I understand they're in the cracks. Those are both excellent law school exam hypotheticals. But it's tough. I can't give you a definitive answer.
Mr. Chair?
Representative O'Driscoll.
I'm going to take that same T-shirt image and logo and put that on a child, on a voter who's coming in. Is that going to be considered where the child and the parent will be asked to leave and depart from the voting line?
Secretary Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, in my judgment, that's an easier call to make. I think the idea of Representative Bonner's bill is that you can't get around the restriction, whatever restriction you decide on, just because a kid's wearing it and not an eligible voter. The idea is to keep the polling place free of whatever falls within these categories, whether it's on the voter or someone else or a pet or anything else.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So keeping the same theme, what happens if there's a disagreement between the election judges? I don't see it that way, but I do. Who's the final arbiter on that?
Yeah.
Secretary Simon.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, very fair question. What happens in reality is typically the head of elections for that jurisdiction, whether it's a township, a city, or a county. If you want to spin it out even further, would there potentially be judicial intervention? Could someone who had the means, number one, or the presence of mind to do it, go and seek emergency relief from a court. I suppose that would be possible. In the real world, that's not very likely. But let me just add, since I've got the microphone, that you know, you're all illustrating here the push and pull. Supreme Court has been pretty clear that it is okay, probably not required, but certainly okay for states. There is a compelling interest, they said in the decision, for states to make the polling place, you know, this is my words, not theirs, basically politics free. That there deserves to be, the language that has been used before, this one I do know, is in OASIS. There is a compelling state interest to create this OASIS. But as legislators, it's your job to figure out the contours of the OASIS. So one way would be to throw your hands up and say, let's just allow everything because we can't make election judges arbiters. I don't think that's what the Supreme Court is saying. They're saying you're entitled to an OASIS. These are hard questions. You're not wrong to answer them. I guess the question is, how can you construct a bill that's tightly enough worded so that you're getting rid of what the court says you can, you're providing that OASIS, but you're not chilling other kinds of free speech. I mean, I'm restating the central divide here. It's tough. There's no easy answer. It's up to you as legislators to craft something with precision.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Secretary, in the community that I live in, we have 8 different precincts. Could one precinct determine that, we think that's political speech, you're going to have to leave, and another say, I had the same thing happen, that wasn't a problem. Thus, arbitrary and potentially capricious, as I started out my comments. How are we going to ensure that that individual who was told no in one polling place, but a similar individual is told yes in another polling place, and that disenfranchise voters?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As with so much that has to do with this process or any other screening process, at any other public event or anything else, human beings are going to come to different decisions. The question for any court in that instance is whether it rises the level, as you say, to pure arbitrariness, or whether there's some sort of equal protection violation, so that and there you get into issues of was the differential treatment based on a certain category? Was it based on race or sex or disability or religion or anything like that? Those are absolutely fair questions for you to ask. These are tough calls. But, you know, I would just submit to you that the sort of, I'm not saying you're counseling this, but if one were to say, well, since there are likely to be different applications of the same standard, that we should throw our hands up and allow everything. That too is problematic. So there's no question there's a balancing act. And there are going to be, in any human run system, different people who come to different judgments. The trick is to make it as uniform and standard as you possibly can. That's the honest answer I can give you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So same idea, moving to some other things that might be somewhat undefined in the proposed bill that Representative Bonner is bringing forward. And I do want to ask her a couple questions on this as well. So I'm going to put three things together because I could ask them one at a time, but they're all kind of the same theme. So we have two of the four major parties that are marijuana parties. Mm-hmm. I have seen over the years, and I know that they're available in retail environments, you can buy a T-shirt that has a marijuana leaf on it. Would that be considered a likeness or close enough to identify with a political party or name, and that individual would once again be asked to depart there? Number two, our current president has had a television show that may or may not have had T-shirts printed that say The Apprentice on there or You're Fired with a likeness on there. Would that be considered problematic for an individual? And then third, if I had a slogan that said free the weed, because that's kind of a vernacular that folks who are of one of those other two major parties is advocating, is that now considered political speech, even though it was a slogan that wasn't necessarily deemed as political speech, and today someone might deem that as such? How are we going to ask those volunteers? We're already having a difficult time securing to make these decisions about whether that is or is not political speech.
Right.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, first let me say again, I think this is a useful exercise. I would say that's going on now. The questions that you're posing are going on right now and have been since the 1800s in Minnesota and in other states over the last century too. These are hard questions. You're right to ask them. I would say the example about the marijuana leaf is a lot like your Disney character that's an elephant. question. It's maybe not the exact logo of a particular party, but it's close enough. I'd have to think about that. I don't know what our office's advice would be under current law or under this piece of legislation. I'd have to think about that. Those are very tough questions, admittedly.
So, Mr. Chair, I can continue on with this, but I'm going to make one more comment, and then I do want to shift the questioning a little bit to ask the author some questions about the bill as well.
Representative Trust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens if someone were to come to the polling place dressed completely in blue? Blue coat, blue hat, blue glasses, blue T-shirt, blue tie, blue everything. Is that considered a political statement when the person standing behind them is dressed the same way but happens to be perhaps in red? And a third person perhaps in green to signify one of the other major parties. Coincidental? I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I mean, that one's a little easier for me. My interpretation, Representative O'Driscoll, Mr. Chair, would be no. Simply a color is not. That's sort of a vernacular term for that we associate offhandedly with one or the other political parties. So I wouldn't say that. I just want to remind everyone that you're absolutely right to ask these in-the-cracks hypotheticals because those are some of the judgments that might be made. I would just say we've been in this space for over a century, as you heard. So it's not new. It's not that Representative Bonner's bill would introduce these difficult hypotheticals. You're right to raise them, but it's not a new thing. Even yesterday, I'm sure it happened in some places, or it happened in 2018 in some of your own elections. It happens from time to time. You're spot on to talk about how these are tough questions, but I just want to emphasize it's not new.
Are you, Representative Driscoll,
I'm
done?
Secretary.
Because I've got another list here of other
individuals. And I understand, and with the fact that I've got some experience on this, I want to be able to bring forward to the committee some things to consider as they're making their deliberations on how they'd like to move forward.
Representative Driscoll,
thank
please
you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, the question I have for you is, in the amendment that we just recently adopted, these rules apply to, on lines 1.15, within 100 feet of the building in which the polling place is situated on primary or election day. What happens with the early voting locations that we have? It's not a problem with political speech, or we don't anticipate there being problems at those, or in my case where I'd have to go down to my county auditor's office. These rules wouldn't apply to me where I would have others that might be standing in line, where I would influence less people, or that's not considered influential because it is not on election day. Can you help me to understand that? Because again, we're going to have folks who are going to have to be making those decisions in the different pop-up polling places or other locations.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Just to be clear, this language is actually very much in line with the language that was already provided in the bill, and it is also consistent with language that is available in about 47 other states and has been upheld by the courts consistently.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Driscoll.
I promise this will be my last question
Thank
for this
you.
Round. You've been very gracious, and I appreciate it.
Please proceed.
This Supreme Court case that made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court originated in Minnesota, so I have a certain affinity for wanting to make sure that since this was the source of that if there's going to be challenges, that it may not guaranteed, but could come from the state of Minnesota again. And I do believe that, I guess I would ask your opinion. I have stated that I believe that this opens it up for being arbitrary and capricious. What are your thoughts on the language? Does it open it up to make it arbitrary and capricious, or is everyone going to be able to understand exactly what the law is asking us to do here based on the language in the amendment?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Again, I just want to clarify that I think this language is actually pretty simple and straightforward. Mm-hmm. It is pretty crisp, and it is consistent with court decisions that have been upheld in 47 other states. And in fact, it is almost identical to that in about half of those states. I could actually break down the numbers of distance that are located within different states. The vast majority of them actually fall within 100 feet. That is consistent with the vast majority of those 47 states. There are a few outliers. There are including a few that have even further distances, which are possibly a little bit more unworkable, like I believe it is Alaska, if I recall correctly, that had 250 feet or some crazy number, but the vast majority of states do stick to this, and they do hold that within primary or election day, that those are clear guidelines for folks to follow.
Thank you. Representative Halvers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this forward. When Minnesota has kind of historically had a, I don't know if it's a certain politeness around elections, maybe because a lot of people tend to be more private about, you know, the way that they vote, or I've always joked that there are marriages in this state that one doesn't know how the other votes, and that's very true. And so when this was, you know, overturned, you know, when our previous rules and understanding of how we can or cannot behave in a polling place with regard to campaigning, I think that Minnesotans were looking for some kind of redress or some kind of way to fill in the gaps that do comport with current understanding with our courts. And I think that this strikes the balance. I think that we know if you're campaigning or not. Does it need to be a sandwich board and a bell with a candidate's name on it? No. But there are attempts very often for people to make their candidate known within the close proximity of a polling place, and there's a lot of passion around that. I think that you're absolutely right, Mr. Secretary, that Minnesotans expect an oasis when it comes to voting. I think that they've been extremely clear on this, and so it's prudent for us to take important action. It sounds like the good news is that we're not the first ones to test this out and test out this language, and that it's been vetted through the court system. And so with regard to experiences in other states, we could hypothesize all day long about what people might do. But how have these questions and challenges been dealt with in other states and the courts? And has there been these kinds of knockdown, drag-out fights over Disney's Dumbo or the look of a leaf or something like that? Mr. Secretary.
Representative Bonner. Mr. Secretary,
yes.
Either one of you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, I can't say that I've surveyed the case law extensively in other states since the Supreme Court decision. I don't know, Representative Bonner, I think you have looked over some of the cases, but all I know is what our lawyers are telling us, and they've reviewed it, and it is true, we are taking a more cautious approach, but it's that balance between the oasis and the law as currently written, which just says anything political. And that, Supreme Court, we know. So we have the marker there. The Supreme Court says you can't just say anything political. That's just impossible to enforce. Mental inventory in their minds of anything that's political. And that gets to Representative Driscoll's hypothetical. Is wearing all red or wearing all blue or wearing all green too political? We're getting, you know, to the point where an election judge just can't administer that. So I think the important thing I would say is that the statute be changed in some way, because we've got a mostly dead statute on the books. Somebody in Minnesota is going to go and look at this law, which still says in black and white, can't have political paraphernalia in the polling place, and not know. There would be no reason to know unless they look it up, that it's really been deemed unenforceable by a court. So it's whatever the taste for specificity or risk is in this committee and in the legislature, but I think it needs to be changed to reflect life after the Supreme Court decision.
And so, Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, if we are doing hypotheticals, so currently under Minnesota statute, you could wear a sandwich board and ring a bell in a polling place. Is that where we're at with Minnesota statute? It's an egregious example, but I think that when we come, you know, Minnesota's come to expect an oasis in their polling places, in a place where they're free from interference from campaigns. Certainly we interfere enough with their lives with television ads and mail and phone calls, and Minnesotans are looking for this, that their vote is their vote, and their time in the polling place is their time as a citizen, free from campaigns. So can it be very egregious at this point in under state law?
Secretary Steinman or Representative Bonner, either one.
Go ahead.
Well, Madam Chair, we're in this weird zone where there really has been no zero litigation that I'm aware of in Minnesota since the Supreme Court case. That's why the advice we're giving to the counties is our best guess about a cautious approach to what the courts would allow. It is just that, though. It's a guess. There is no test case in Minnesota that I know of at any level since that Supreme Court decision. So given the language that Representative Bonner read from or excerpted, what they're saying is OASIS, yes, but not something so loosey-goosey, so standardless as just saying anything political, something in between. And it's the legislature's job to decide what the in-between is. I think Representative O'Driscoll's and Representative Nash's hypotheticals are useful to ponder in terms of where you want to draw that line, but some line must be drawn. I know it's tough, but as I said, this isn't new. We've been doing this for over a century. I would imagine something like some of the hypotheticals that have been raised in the occasional polling place across our 4,000 precincts every election. So it's not new. It's a question of where you want to draw the line. Our advice to counties has been, again, I want to be clear, our advice to counties has been to take a very cautious approach to say what you can. The OASIS consists of saying that any candidate or ballot question or party on the ballot that day is okay to exclude from the polling place. But if you want to wear your Tim Pawlenty or your Mark Dayton t-shirt, that's fine because they're no longer on the ballot for any office. That's our interpretation of the most cautious approach under current law. But even that is a guess. It is a guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that came out in a lot of the court cases, just to be clear, is the standard of reasonableness. And I think we talk about that a lot today, and a lot of the examples we have here today. And I can tell you in full disclosure that I have served as an election judge on many occasions. And one thing that I know about people who work in polling places is that they are passionate about making sure that every individual that has the ability to cast a vote should cast a vote. In fact, they would love it if we could get 100% participation across the board. And that said, generally speaking, election judges do not ever want to turn someone away. They don't want to do that. And they are going to apply a standard of reasonableness. So if you're coming in with a t-shirt that has Dumbo on it, I think we can all reasonably suggest that that is perfectly fine and acceptable, that that is not a specific to an individual candidate, it is not specific to an individual ballot question, and it is not specific to an individual party. And so I think that the people of Minnesota and our election judges, I think they are much smarter than we're giving them credit for. And I do believe that this is actually a workable standard, not to mention it is based on the two examples that the Chief Justice gave as the best examples of best of breed for how we put those lines and sort of make that a little bit more crisp. Not only that, ours actually goes even just a little bit further in making it even a little bit more crisp than the best examples that the justices gave. So in reality, I think that we have a very good and very strong case for why this particular language will be upheld and how it can be applied in very reasonable and simple terms across the state. And it is also, of course, consistent with the advice that we have received from legal counsel and that the Secretary of State has been advising to polling places across the state for the last couple of years.
Thank you. Representative Halverson.
Just one more piece of clarification with regard to the way that the courts have ruled on these types of laws. So with the election judges being the arbiters of what's acceptable and not acceptable, is that consistent with the rulings of the court that we allow our election officials to play this role? And because I think there's some question about whether or not they should be playing this role, and do the courts agree that this is the role for them to play?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Halverson, that one I do know. There has been no litigation that I know of that has excluded election judges as decision makers in that role. Imperfect, perhaps, and I think the hypotheticals asked are very fair ones. But the courts say, yeah, imperfect, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but imperfect, yes, but it is what it is. Yes, we are going to empower. There's nothing arbitrary or capricious about investing that authority in election judges. Now, it would be different if there were some discrepancy based on a protected category, that would be a different situation. If some elections were allowing Lutherans to wear certain apparel but not Methodists, that would be something else again. But there's been no finding that I know of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. So another hypothetical, since we've been talking about that. Let's say somebody that lives in my congressional district, which is, well, both CD3 and CD6, is wearing a Tom Emmer for Congress t-shirt, and they're working there, but they actually vote in some other place. So let's say they live in CD5. If they're wearing that t-shirt, is that going to get them bounced out of the polling place?
Mr. Secretary.
Because Tom Emmer doesn't run in CD5.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, if I'm understanding the hypothetical, it has to do with what is within 100 feet of the polling place, whether it's an employee, whether it's a voter, whether it's an election judge or a poll worker or anyone else. So I guess the answer there, to my mind, is a little clearer, that if it's a candidate who's on the ballot that day, is the hypothetical meant to suggest that not in that precinct? Is that the idea?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Yes. So
okay.
A volunteer worker for Congressman Emmer is out doing their CD6 thing, but they live in CD5. They drive home on election day in order to get there to vote, and they're still wearing their Tom Emmer for Congress apparel.
Yeah.
As I read this bill, they're going to get thrown out.
Mr. Secretary.
So all I can tell you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, all I can tell you is what our office's cautious advice is to the counties.
Hmm.
Our office's cautious advice to the counties is about what's on the ballot in that precinct on that day. If Tom Emmer's name does not appear on the ballot in that precinct that day, then the Tom Emmer t-shirt, our current advice in writing to counties is that that would be okay. He's not on the ballot in that precinct on that day.
And Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Appreciate that. Another hypothetical for you. Some folks like tattoos. I don't, but some do. Let's say they had a giant GOP elephant on their arm tattooed, and, you know, as some do in Minnesota, don't wear coats until it's really cold, like negative 30. And they walk into the polling place and they have a short sleeve t-shirt on. Is that going to get them thrown out? Because I don't believe that they're wearing anything. That's actually now a part of their skin.
Yeah.
So just trying to throw that out there, because what I'm trying to get at to both you and Representative Bonner is that your bill doesn't address these things. And you said that you wanted to find the safest course, but I don't believe that this is particularly pursuing a safe course. I think this is opening us up for another $1.2 million lawsuit. And I think that if the devil is in the details, as we always hope that it is, that we're going to cover the details and not wind up in front of the Supreme Court again, because my guess is, from what I'm seeing, it's not going to go so good.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I kind of enjoy these hypotheticals. I think, that one isn't as close a case as you might believe it is. At least to me it isn't. I think it's the likeness in the polling place. And honestly, I don't think it's a question of being turned away. I agree with Representative Bonner. The practice is, and our advice is, to just simply ask someone, which 99% of the chance of the times works, hey, do you mind just covering that up? Or if you don't have a code, could you sort of cover that up? We have a rule here, that sort of thing. So it's exceedingly rare that someone is truly thrown out of a polling place. It's usually a human interaction and asked to cover something up. In the vast, vast majority of instances, people comply with that.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But on line 1.11, it says a person may not. So by having that very prescriptive language, and let's say I have a tattoo, or, you know, we go through Representative O'Driscoll's t-shirt drawer, which apparently he's got one with some sort of herbal item on it. If they were to wear that, it says may not.
Right.
It doesn't really open for interpretation. It just says it's a very binary thing. It either is or it isn't. And I'm troubled that we're looking at another $1.2 million Supreme Court defense to have the language that's in here challenged because it doesn't seem, to use Representative Bonner's word, crisp. I don't believe that it is. So, and just because I'm thinking about this, Mr. Chair, because of some of the concerns that we've raised, I'd like to ask for a roll call on this.
Roll call has been requested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I may,
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, first off, the first part that you mentioned on line 1.11 is actually current law. That is not actually a change proposed here today. That is how it has been for 153 years, since 1853. So that's 127 years. That has not changed. It has remained the same as it has always been and has not been challenged up to this point. In terms of the idea of, we can sit all day and talk about hypotheticals about tattoos on your arm and Dumbo on your shirt, but the reality is, here again, we go back to that legal standard of reasonableness that was discussed at some length in the Supreme Court case. And I think, quite frankly, any reasonable individual could understand the difference between those things. Not only could they do that, again, serving as an election judge, there are a couple rules of being an election judge that are very crisp and clear. One is that for folks who are actually working inside a polling place or around a polling place, they make it very clear what those guidelines are and not to wear articles of clothing that could potentially interrupt the flow of democracy, right? And making sure that we have that oasis, if you will, in which people can vote their conscience and do so readily without fear of intimidation. And I think that is really the whole intent behind this law. And again, polling workers, I have seen time and time again, if there were ever to be a question, generally speaking, poll workers are going to err on the side of safety. They are going to let people vote. The only cases that I would see that a poll worker would maybe raise an objection is something that is a little bit more extreme. And in this case, they are very well defined what those cases are. And in fact, the cases that are defined in this language are not only consistent with the standards that were outlined as shining examples by the Supreme Court, but they are even more crisp than was suggested. So I do feel very confident that this would actually work and that it would withstand the challenge.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Bonner, I'm very well aware that the existing statute may not, but the items that you're adding are, in my opinion, flying in the face of may not, because you're opening the door for some interpretation. So I'm fully aware of what is and what isn't statute, but again, I think that this is very, you say crisp, I don't believe that it is. I have problems with it. I don't think that the homework that needed to be done is evidence in front of us. I think we've given you some examples, and you may choose to think that they're hyperbolic, and you may choose to think that they are themselves capricious, but the Secretary has already given Representative O'Driscoll and I credit for writing a couple of really good legal questions. So I think that by virtue of his declaring them to be good questions, that we can't dismiss them as capricious or outrageous or whatever you wish to call them. I think that if it meets the test to have a lawyer say, wow, that would be a really fun question for a test, that they should be considered. They should. And I think you are allowing for folks who don't, I mean, I haven't heard that we're training people on what this law means. Because I would really love to see the fiscal note on that. That'd be expensive, I think, to have a little course in what does and doesn't constitute political speech. I think that this is not well written. I think that there's a lot of work to be done still. So I'm voting no, but you probably figured that already. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. I have a question. I think that part of the underlying discussion here is everyone wanting to make sure that everybody gets to vote, right? So if you show up and you make a mistake and you've got a jacket with a campaign
logo on it or a candidate's logo on it, and your election judge says, hey, you can't wear that in there. Election judges have the ability to allow people to vote outside of the polling place? Are there, I know that we've got examples for people with disabilities who can't come in. I've also, when I was answering calls to the League of Women Voters, I talked to somebody who had just had a baby and needed her ballot to be brought to her. It's like, it's amazing what lengths, and it turns out that that could happen. And yeah. So I know that election judges can make some of those determinations. So is somebody's vote protected if they're found to not be in line with what these laws, rules and laws are, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, yes. The answer is yes, and that's a great example. Okay. I should have thought of it earlier. We have curbside voting in Minnesota, and it requires that someone could be literally in their car, and it requires that two election judges, not one but two, representing different political parties, go and deliver that to the person. So that would be one option, one that I imagine is used. These are very rare circumstances where an issue comes up at all. I don't think any representative is wrong to ask these hypotheticals. They're interesting. They should be thought about. I agree with that. Again, we have a semi-dead statute on the books. We know the Supreme Court has said that there's a compelling state interest in having an oasis, but these line-drawing exercises, they're hard. They are. You've got to draw the line where you think it's appropriate. We've drawn the line in a certain way that we admit is cautious, but in an abundance of caution, we want to minimize friction at the polling place. That is a legislative decision. You know, I don't need to tell you, you know better than I do, to legislate is to draw lines a lot, and it's a tough call sometimes. Yeah. But it's that oasis on the one hand versus something overly punitive on the other. We know what the Supreme Court says is too punitive, which is just to say anything political. That went too far from the standpoint of the First Amendment. So what is something less than that that still gives you the oasis? Reasonable minds can disagree.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification, if Mr. Guerin can help us with this. The Secretary indicated how they would counsel judges if the question arose, and I'm going back to the Tom Emmer, where you were working for a candidate outside of a district, but you went to CD5 where you lived to vote, and you had indicated that, oh, that would be an easy one to resolve because Tom Emmer's not in the ballot on CD5. As I read the amendment, and this is where I would like Mr. Gehring to provide some clarity for those assembled and for the committee. It says a polling place a couple of times in that statement, and my interpretation of a polling place would be a generic place where one on that day, a primary or a general election day, you would go and cast a ballot. I don't see any differentiating language. I would say unless you are not, the candidate is not on the ballot in that particular precinct or that particular district or the ballot question and so forth, as you enumerated here. So I'm just wondering if Mr. Gehring can give us a little bit of background as we're deliberating and contemplating how we want to move forward with this.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm not sure I'm following your question. So is it about whether the candidate should be on the ballot or?
Mr. Chair.
Else?
Representative O'Driscoll.
So to simplify that, the Secretary said, oh, we would counsel that because the individual is coming to CD5 where they lived to vote, that person would not have to remove the Tom Emmer shirt as was put forward in the question. My interpretation of this lines, and again, I'm not an attorney, and that's why I'm looking for nonpartisan staff to help me. A polling place to me means that on election day there's a lot of polling places, and it doesn't say unless the candidate is not on the ballot in that particular polling place or that precinct or ballots being cast in that location for the questions. I would think that would mean any candidate that was on the ballot statewide or in any capacity would be prohibited from having that particular type of logo, t-shirt likeness, etc. That's what I'm questioning is what does a polling place mean? Is it an individual location or is it a polling place generically being applied to a place where on election day several of them, an individual may cast a ballot?
Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Representative O'Driscoll, so the way I would read this is that the polling place in this language would apply to every polling place in the state and we need to have to be constitutional, the standard would need to apply equally to all polling places.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll, we're going to be going to vote here pretty soon.
That's fine.
So.
Yeah. Again, I just want people to have full knowledge of what those words meant. So that just to clarify, if a person who is working in CD6 with a Tom Emmer shirt, who lives in CD5, comes and votes, that would be considered political speech under this amendment that was adopted to the bill. And again, that's unfair for me to phrase it that way, Mr. Gehring, but I think you kind of understand where I was looking at. That would be considered, because a polling place, as you said you interpret it, would be generic in nature. And that's all I'm trying to figure out, is what is generic and what is not. I don't see language that says specific in here. And so I'm just trying to see clarification for the committee as they're making their decision.
Would you like to respond, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll. So the way I hear your question is you're asking about whether the candidate has to be on the ballot in the precinct at the election, and this language as drafted currently doesn't specify.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to a vote. The clerk will take it.
Chair Dean?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Halverson?
Aye.
Representative Mann?
Yes.
Representative New?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Being 5 ayes and 3 nays, the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Bonner. You have House File 1328, and I believe you do have an amendment. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to recommend that House File 1328 be recommended to the Committee on Government Operations, and I would like to move the DE amendment, which will get the bill into the shape in which I would like it.
Great. Thank you for moving the DE amendment. Any questions regarding the DE amendment? Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, if you could just go over some of the changes from the original bill to the DE, that would be helpful.
Representative Bonner.
Yes, so we've heard this in various forms before, but in essence, this streamlines the process a little bit from previous iterations of this bill. It does allow for pre-registration of individuals between 16 and 18. It adds a process by which citizenship is in fact confirmed when individuals apply for a driver's license. It sends minimum information into the Secretary of State to determine eligibility and certify that on the back end. And it does also allow for an opt-out provision here, which is also streamlined and allows for a checkbox on a receipt at the end of the transaction that can be deposited in a box at the exit. So individuals wishing not to register to vote can in fact not have their information transmitted to the Secretary of State. In states where this has been implemented, for folks who may have buyer's remorse and leave the polling place, generally speaking, they have actually had the opportunity to mail in that opt-out as well. But that's how it's generally been applied in other states.
Okay, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Okay, the bill is in the shape you would like it. Representative Bonner, if you'd like to speak a little bit more to the bill, that would be great. Okay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Here we have a little bit of a variation on something you've heard in the past. It builds on the lessons learned that we've taken from about 17 other states who currently have automatic voter registration on the rolls. As some of you may know, in my day job, I spend a great deal of time working on finding efficiency, streamlining process, and of course, saving money for my clients. But more importantly, I believe that government should in fact serve real people. The folks who actually pay our salary and expect that government should work for them and make their lives just a little bit easier. AVR, or automatic voter registration, does this in spades, and it saves hard-earned tax dollars. We know that upfront electronic verification not only cuts staff time, but it also cuts cost. It costs about an average of 4 cents on the front end to do this versus same-day voter registration, which costs an average of 83 cents for each time. The bill does this with a smaller footprint and proven results, which also means the cost goes down. The bill does three basic things. It pre-registers individuals 16 to 18 and prepares them to engage in our democracy while underscoring the expectations of the rights of citizenship. Number two, it registers those who are renewing, replacing, or changing address while performing verification of citizenship by trained professionals that do this literally every day. And that verification then will go on to the Secretary of State, who does a robust eligibility verification and confirmation. As many of you know, the outcome of that verification process is that anyone who is in fact deemed eligible and has fulfilled all of the requirements will be sent a card in the mail that indicates that they are in fact registered to vote and verifies their precinct and polling location. For any individuals who are deemed not to be eligible by the Secretary of State, they will get a very nice card that lets them know that they are in fact not eligible and gives them a reminder that they are not allowed to do so. That is current practice. So that remains the same. Point number three, it does provide a simple and easy opt-out process at the end of the transaction by simply checking a box and depositing it on your way out. And of course, we do have the option to certainly mail that receipt back in if someone should have a little buyer's remorse and wish to do that at a later time. I should mention that generally speaking, for states who have instituted this, the general opt-out rate is roughly around 4%, very low. So that by and large, 96% of the citizens do in fact appreciate the ability to have that automatic voter registration to simplify their lives, and they are grateful for it. Now just a little piece on why I'm doing this. You know, back in the day when I went to Gustavus, I lived in the International House and had friends from literally all over the world. And I remember very vividly, we had a discussion one day where one of my friends had said to me, well, you know, in my country, we automatically are registered to vote when we're born as a citizen. And she said, you know, it's striking to me that in a country which we often consider to be this beacon of freedom and democracy, that Americans do not give that same privilege to their own citizens. They claim that they value freedom and democracy over all else, but the most fundamental part in obtaining that democracy is the ability to have a vote, to have a voice, right? One vote, one voice. And I think that it's time that Minnesota steps up to make that a reality for Minnesotans and literally put our money where our mouth is. This model is more efficient. It cuts down on costs and staff time. It ensures that every eligible voter is registered to vote if they choose. And it has the same verifications for citizenship at the front end as the previous bills. But the back end, it allows for the continuation of the back end verification from the Secretary of State to verify that the voter rolls are accurate and complete. And now with that, I do have a testifier here from the Center for Secure and Modern Elections to testify on behalf of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. If the testifier could come down. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sam Oliker-Friedland. I'm Chief Counsel for the Center for Secure and Modern Elections. We work on voter registration modernization policies nationwide, and I am testifying in support of House File 1328 to bring Minnesota in line with the 22 other states in the District of Columbia that use automatic voter registration to ensure that voter rolls are accurate and complete and do so in a way that is efficient for the government. I'm going to begin my testimony by taking a minute and describing why we think that this bill as amended actually very well comports with our best practices for automatic voter registration and precisely how that works. So the reason this policy makes so much sense is that we go into government offices all the time. We're giving them all the information they need for voter registration purposes, our name, our date of birth, our citizenship status, our residence address. And automatic voter registration takes that information that citizens are already submitting to the government and efficiently transmits that to election officials to register those people to vote. At DPS, which is the first mandatory agency in this bill, where I'll focus for the purpose of this testimony, this is basically, we like to call the DMV the sort of most robust point of identity verification that happens in American society. This is where you have to walk in with three forms of identification to prove this and three forms of identification to prove that. And we take that proven secure identity verification and use that to form the basis of a voter registration record. In this bill, only United States citizens who have confirmed their United States citizenship with a document at DPS will be automatically registered to vote. For anyone who walks in to DPS with such a document, they will have their information transmitted unless they decline. As Representative Bonner mentioned, we place the decline on a receipt at the end of the transaction. This is a best practice because it actually takes some of the pressure off of the DPS clerk from having to sort of interrupt the DMV conversation to have a conversation about voter registration. Remember, these are folks we all know are eligible. The automatic voter registration process then allows you to put on that receipt all the information they need. They can easily check that checkbox and drop it off in the Dropbox if they don't want to be registered to vote. And if they do want to be registered to vote, they just walk out of DPS without any further action on their part. At this point, the information is transferred to the Secretary of State securely and electronically. This is incredibly important for the cost savings that Representative Bonner mentioned. As she mentioned, there's a study out of Arizona that showed that processing a paper voter registration form costs an average of 83 cents. Processing an electronic voter registration record costs an average of 4 cents. So the secure electronic transfer of this information into the Secretary of State system will allow for those cost savings and avoid errors. When we have paper voter registration forms, which is what happens oftentimes today, you know, not only does the person have to write their, you know, write all their information in longhand often on these forms, but then often someone in the county auditor's office will have to type that information into the system. If errors happen at that point, you could end up with people not registered to vote or registered at the wrong address or even in the wrong precinct. This secure electronic transfer avoids that issue. And at that point, these voter registration applications undergo the exact same strict verification process that Secretary Simon's office and the counties do for every voter registration application that comes in today. They verify that the person is eligible. If the person is verified eligible by the election officials, they are registered to vote and sent a notice to that effect. This reform is great as a way to ensure that new people are in the process, but actually one of the key benefits of this that we see in other states is keeping the voter rolls up to date and accurate. In other states, about 80% of automatic voter registration transactions are voter registration updates. This means that when a person moves, you know, as long as they're telling DPS that they moved or telling DVS that they moved, that move will be reflected on their voter registration record. They won't need to go through the same day registration process, and they'll receive their polling place in the mail without having any further action on their part. It helps avoid duplicate voter registration applications because it ensures that applications all have driver's license numbers on them, and helps keep the voter rolls secure and up to date. I do want to mention that this is a reform that 22 states in D.C. have adopted. This is a bipartisan reform. This has been introduced by Republican and Democratic co-sponsors, passed by Republican and Democratic legislators, signed by Republican and Democratic governors, and implemented by Republican and Democratic secretaries of state in states as different as Massachusetts and West Virginia, Michigan and Colorado, California and Georgia. We think that this is a reform that ensures that eligible voters are on the list, ensures that voter rolls are accurate and clean, and saves money for the government. We urge passage. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Olicker Friedland. Are there any other members in the public who would like to speak? Okay, we'll go into question and answers at this time. Representative Nash, you might want to just stay there, Mr. Olker Friedland. Some questions may be directed towards you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Secretary is still here. I'd like to maybe ask if he would come down to help us with some of these issues.
Mr. Secretary, are you able to come down at this moment? Okay. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for coming back down. And I'll be brief because I know Representative New has some questions. But I think some of my concerns are around the transfer of data from, really, it could be anywhere from what I'm reading. It could be at locations not necessarily at a motor vehicle. You have on lines 5.20, Representative Bonner, a state agency of state, tribal, or local government. My concern is the transfer of that data may not be secure, and you're predicating them enrolling people upon them having proper security measures. And I think we both know, Representative Bonner, that that's not something that comes cheaply, and that many of the people who are you are going to enable to do that are going to have to expend some cash to do that they may not have. So, Mr. Secretary, is your office currently prepared to handle this from, I guess, agents that might be doing this on your behalf? And do you feel that your department is also sufficiently able to handle the security needs of this bill?
Secretary Stein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, the short answer is yes. But I would say this. There's no question that this bill will have a fiscal note. I know the last version of it did. I'll take a look at it. I know this isn't a finance committee. But, yeah, in terms of the logistics of this, we feel good about this. We feel that this is workable. I have brought here some folks from my office who can answer far better than I some of the technical questions about the subjects you're talking about. But can I just say very briefly, and I'm sorry I have to just leave in a couple minutes.
Okay.
I just want to say I'm supportive of the bill. The one thing that you heard me say last year, I think, when this bill was heard was, you know, we get caught up in terms like automatic voter registration, which sounds like a sweeping, huge upheaval. If I heard that term, I would think so. But it's really, at base, really a minor modification to what we have now in many respects. We have an opt-in system. When you go to get a driver's license or renew a driver's license, you take the iChart test, you do everything else, and there's a box on the form, if you've ever noticed. Notice the next time you go in there. And it says, check here if you want to be registered to vote. All that automatic voter registration would do, as grandiose and huge and sweeping as the title sounds, in essence, is reverse the presumption. So in that situation, you go in, you take the iChart test, you do everything you need to do, same document, same box, and now instead of saying, check here if you want to be registered, it in essence says, check here if you don't want to be registered. I'm not saying there aren't questions to be answered. You should ask them. This is a big one. It has bipartisan support. But you got to get the details right. I just want to put it in some perspective. In my limited time, though it's not your question, but I'd like to use the microphone if I can to talk about a couple reasons, a couple technical parts of the bill, because we do need to get the details right, that our office just wants to weigh in on. I'm supportive of the overall policy. I think it would make the election rolls cleaner, more accurate, more trustworthy even than they are right now, and minimize a lot of hassle and delay on election day. Imagine, you know, in the last presidential election, we had 335,000 people who registered same day. In the last midterm, it was something like 180,000. Imagine if that were cut by like 90%. There are people perhaps on this committee who over the years, I'm not making any accusation, but might have some misgivings or questions about same day voter registration. If I could tell you or someone could tell you that that number could be reduced by 80 or 90% of the number registering on the same day, I think that merits a second look at this legislation. I do want to, just to make a clean record of it here, talk about some technical details where we part company from this version of the bill. Again, this is all a work in process, but I think over time we need to state what those concerns are. They're technical in nature in terms of how the data is shared. But there is one overall concept that I want to talk to you about, and that's the designation piece. And this is a statement against interest, against my own personal interest, perhaps. This bill, as currently written, designates the Secretary of State as the person who gets to choose what the AVR, or automatic voter registration, state agencies are. And while I'm flattered that you would consider giving me that power, I think it's probably the better case is to put that in statute. You never know who the next Secretary of State is going to be. 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, I hope you would trust me with those decisions. But I think the safer thing is to put them in statute and not have me or my predecessors, or my successors rather, have that authority, because it might wax and wane over the years. You might have someone on the list, then off the list, then on the list. And I think it's better to put that in statute. I'll just say that. And then the other issue, of course, is the fiscal note and who pays for implementation in the agencies that would be designated by the Secretary of State or in statute. And again, this bill, I guess our office should be flattered, gives us the authority to determine what security measures are appropriate for each agency and therefore what the cost would be. Again, I think there may be better and more streamlined ways to do that. So those are two technical concerns we have, but overall, as you've heard, many states have adopted this, red states, blue states. It really is a win-win in terms of getting more people into the system earlier. If you have misgivings about same-day voter registration, that hundreds of thousands of people are registering same day, if that applies to you, this is something you should really, over the medium and long term, take a look at here, because it's a way to do things more quickly, more cost-effectively, and have voter rolls that are much more accurate even than they are right now. So that's what I'll say. I'm sorry, I do have to go, but I don't want to leave you empty-handed. We have folks from our office who can answer technical questions of all kinds about the data.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And Representative Bonner, it sounds like there's a conversation that may need to take place regarding a possible amendment before going on operation.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can work on some of my concerns. I do think, Mr. Chair, that...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, point of order. Who has the floor right now, or who has the microphone?
I believe the question was from Representative Nash.
Okay.
Initially, I interjected to Representative Bonner that I believe she has the obligation or duty to consult with Secretary of State, and I allowed Mr. Nash to jump back into his question without recognizing him directly, but I would have recognized him directly. So,
okay,
Representative
thank you.
Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Bonner, I think we should talk about this more. I know we're coming up against the time. I think that the cost that's going to have to go into enabling some of the governmental units that you want to perform this from a security perspective is going to be pretty expensive, and I think that's concerning. But I want Representative New to be able to ask some of her questions, but I also will ask for a roll call on this, Mr. Chair, and then I will give my time up.
A roll call has been requested. Representative Bonner, and then we'll move to you, Representative New.
Yes, very briefly. Mike Desfire would like to say something, and then I have actually something to add as well.
And Representative Nash, I think that's a very good question, and just want to provide some context for how other states have dealt with this issue that might be helpful. One of the reasons that we generally advocate for a relatively flexible determination of what other agencies can participate is actually for exactly the reason you've identified. In Rhode Island, for example, and Washington State, which have expanded their automatic voter registration systems to their Medicaid agencies, it turns out that when you're building all of those security measures and building that database transfer, you can build that from scratch out of nowhere, and you are absolutely correct, that costs a lot of money. If they are already going through some sort of redo of their application process technologically, and let's say maybe they do that at some point in the future, they found that it was actually free with the contractors they work with to say, also, you know, when you work on the data transfer from our application system to all these federal agencies and these other state agencies, add in the Secretary of State to that list. And they were able to actually see huge cost savings working with those other agencies by sort of taking the time when they were already doing a build through their application system. So that may be helpful
in
terms of considering
that. Olker Friedland, and did you want to respond,
Representative
Nash, just briefly?
Yeah, thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
And we'll move on to Representative.
Well, we're not currently building that. We don't currently have that underway. It would require a great number of APIs to be written, and that scares the bejeebers out of me. So, thank you,
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. I am a little confused as to why there's two separate issues being combined into this bill, and I think it adds to the confusion. So, for example, and I know we don't have really much time for questions at all, but on 2.5 and on, it is the certification process that an application must contain to certify voter eligibility. Now, with the automatic voter registration, these things, it seems, would be moot because they would not have to go through this application process. So I'm not sure why this is still here. But the change is concerning, adding 16-year-olds here, particularly when you look at lines 2.16 to 2.818, the penalties. And I don't know the answer to this, and I'm hoping you will, Representative Bonner. Is a 16-year-old allowed by law to enter into such an agreement, a certification, a contract stating these things and certifying these things with punishable up to 5 years and in prison or up to $10,000 fine? Is a 16-year-old even able to do that?
Representative Bonner.
No, they are not currently.
Okay, so
Representative New.
Major red flag with this bill all over the place, but that's just one. Also, there have been multiple references.
One moment here, I think.
Just to clarify, I think that the phone-a-friend from the audience was not a no, but a need clarification on the answer. Is that what I understand? Okay, so the answer is that we need clarification on that, and I've carried this bill in the past, and that question has not been brought up, but they're not put into the system until they turn 18. Yes.
Representative.
They certainly will be certifying that they are eligible to be pre-registered to vote. The next thing is a box was referenced multiple times.
If I may.
A box was referenced multiple times for those leaving DPS, theoretically, with this receipt. There's no reference to a box in the bill. So I'm wondering where that comes from, how that would be implemented, how that's paid for, because certainly there will be a cost for that. I know the appropriation was removed from the original bill to the DE. There used to be an appropriation, which seems more appropriate. There'll be a significant cost to this. So what's with the box?
Representative Pong.
Just to be clear, Representative New, we already provide a receipt for the transaction. We would just merely be adding a box on the bottom of the receipt.
Mr. Representative
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was reference to a box where the receipt could be deposited if they do want to opt out. That box currently does not exist, but to add one in every facility across the state, there's certainly a cost to that. And that box is not referenced in the language, but both testifiers.
And that
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative New, that has typically been a recommendation on how to handle that and how other states have handled this to make sure that they make it as easy as possible for staff at the location in order to collect those items.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that probably needs clarification, and certainly there's a cost to that. That would need an appropriation to be able to cover that cost. My question is on collecting all of the necessary required information, and again, I don't know the answer to this, does DPS currently collect all of the information necessary to register to vote? And particularly, I mean, my reference is the list of things that the applicant would certify normally, but I don't know that DPS is searches for things like court-ordered guardianship, in which the court order revokes a right to vote. I don't know that they evaluate legally incompetent to vote or felonies. Did DPS go through all of those things? And if DPS doesn't, does the Secretary of State currently certify all of those things?
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative New. I am receiving nodding heads from the audience from the Secretary of State's office that they do, in fact, verify all of those items.
Representative New.
What does the Department of Public Safety verify for all of this? And what information then would the Secretary of State verify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative New, the Department of Public Safety is verifying the documents that would allow for citizenship and eligibility. The other pieces of that would be vetted by the Secretary of State as they are currently today.
And Representative New, I believe we have someone from Secretary of State's office. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is David Maeda. I'm the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State. So the current process is we get information from DPS, basically the driver's license number and or the last word of the Social Security number. SVRS does a check on that, and if the number is then sent to the county to verify. The court information we get, we get a report from the court monthly that contains felony information, guardianship information. That, again, is sent to the counties to process against any potential matches in SVRS. So technically, our office is not doing the verifying. It's the counties that do that.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can I ask, currently, if someone is currently registered to vote, you get something back saying that they are a felon. Does that then revoke that registration, or does that create a challenge status to a registration?
Mr. Chair and Representative New.
Mr. Veda, before you proceed, let's be clear that a felon is a label. It's an individual with a felony conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. I appreciate that.
Proceed,
that's a good
Mr.
clarification.
Veda.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, if the voter has a current record in SVRS, it gets challenged for the felony status.
So the registration remains. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The registration remains. It just incurs a challenged status.
Correct.
Thank you.
And I should clarify, too,
Mr. Chair, Vader.
Representative New, if we get information from the courts and the person is not registered to vote, that would get forwarded to the county attorney because for a potential felony for trying to register to vote.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Veda.
In the case of someone that's not already registered to vote within SVRS, if they're already registered to vote within SVRS, that's when the challenge occurs. We want to make sure that record is marked challenged.
Okay.
Representative New, we've got about 2 minutes, and then we're going to take a vote. So
thank you.
Make your last question really good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, so many questions. I mean, clearly this bill is not ready for prime time. But I guess in light of that, I will add there's language elsewhere that eliminates penalties for the individual, which is appropriate if they're being automatically registered to vote, and they have been erroneously registered with some of these problems, then that should happen. However, there are other sections that talk about the inactive or challenged designation, and I understand an inactive designation being removed.
Representative New, could you reference the line number?
Yes, we're looking at lines, well, 5.3 to 5.12, but really towards the end, 5.12 discusses the challenged designation, but it's saying that with public safety, well, no registered voter shall be designated inactive due to failure to vote for 5 years if this section indicates that anytime their driver's license is updated, which happens every 4 years, which means that no one would ever be deemed inactive. That status would effectively go away. Is that my understanding? Is that correct, Representative Bonner? That's my understanding of this language.
Representative Bonner?
I would have to review that. That is not something that I have an answer to at this point, but I would certainly be willing to look in and research that particular item for you.
Okay.
And Representative Bonner, Representative New, this might be the case where someone is elderly and they are no longer driving, and so they don't renew their license, they would still remain on the voter files, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And specifically, this is referencing people who are having updates to their license. So that inactive status would effectively be eliminated for anyone who is renewing a license. But my concern is that it also removes the challenged designation. And I'm not sure why that challenged designation would be removed at the same time.
Representative Bonner, and then we're going to go to a vote.
All right. I think I've said enough.
Yes. Well, thank you. And in fact, I will take a deeper look at that particular language and make sure that there are no issues there, and speak with the Secretary of State and other stakeholders on that particular item. I would also like to mention that I do know going in that the automatic registration at other agencies, that 5.19, I have conferred with the Secretary of State, and I know he does have some reservations about that section as that were brought up today. And I am actively working with him offline to follow along with any suggested recommendations to that section that he may have, and I will be also willing to explore the questions that Representative New brought up here today as it continues down the road, and hopefully we can have an amendment in place by its next stop.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Sounds like you'll have a little bit of work to do should this bill pass out of this committee onto government operation. A roll call has been requested, so a clerk will take the roll.
Chair Dean?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Halverson?
Aye.
Representative Mann?
Yes.
Representative New?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Being five ayes and three nays, the bill is on its way to government operations. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Referred. Oh, we are adjourned.